I certainly hope that you have seen the magnificent new film called Dunkirk. It is worth seeing. It is an absolute masterwork. And more important than it being an important and well-crafted film, it is also a very important means for all of us to better know the story of Dunkirk, of what happened there, the evacuation that made an enormous difference in the way the Second World War ultimately played out. This was not an Allied victory. It was actually something sort of plucked out of the jaws of a terrible Allied defeat. But it had that evacuation of hundreds of thousands of Allied troops from the beaches of Dunkirk not occurred as it did, we very likely would have seen the Second World War play out in a very different way. And had that happened, we would be living in a very different world right now. So it's hard to overestimate the significance of Dunkirk. And yet, for so many of us, particularly Americans, we just vaguely know the name Dunkirk, know perhaps it was something important in the Second World War, and know very little beyond that. This marvelous new film has certainly done a lot to change that for any of us who've had the pleasure of seeing it. One of the historical consultants on this film is a very fine and gifted author and a historian by the name of Joshua Levine. And I am excited to be able to speak with Joshua Levine about his book Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture, in which he tells us a great deal of not only about Dunkirk itself, but also helps us understand some of the very intriguing choices that were made in the crafting of this marvelous film. The book is published by William Morrow, a division of HarperCollins. Also by Joshua Levine are such books as The Secret History of the Blitz, Operation Fortitude, Forgotten Voices of the Somme, Forgotten Voices of Dunkirk, and so on. This book, again, called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture, Joshua Levine, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. Very, very good to be here.
I'm very, very excited to be speaking with you. Can you tell us, please, the level of understanding and remembrance among the British public, if it's possible to make such a wild generalization? But I'm just curious. I would suspect, I would hope that the story of Dunkirk lives on more vividly and is more profoundly remembered and appreciated in Britain than it is, for instance, in the rest of the free world.
It is. I mean, there's no doubt that it's much better remembered in Britain than it is in the States, for example. But having said that, anybody who's my age, anyone who's in their 40s or above, knows about Dunkirk instinctively, sort of grew up with it, grew up with the story of the evacuation of the British Army that kept the war alive, that kept the war going, that kept freedom alive. But if you are younger than that now in Britain, it's very possible that you won't know what Dunkirk was. You'll have heard the name, because this idea of Dunkirk spirit has survived all the way through the years. The idea of Dunkirk spirit being, you know, British people being at their best when their backs are against the wall, when things are tough, that's when British people get going. This is kind of almost cliche that's built up, that the British like to repeat about themselves. And that got going because of Dunkirk, because, as you say, precisely, you know, it was a defeat. Once things had got really, really hard, that's when the Navy and the small ships were able to come over to rescue the British Expeditionary Force. That only happened once things had become almost impossible. So this idea that the British really only get going when things are difficult, that, you know, I think that idea was already around, but it became crystallized in Dunkirk spirit. And it's been used endlessly down the years as a way of sort of British people patting themselves on the back. Anytime things get difficult, that's all right, we'll be fine. We've got Dunkirk spirit. So, you know, in fact, you know, the funny thing is, it's only ever been really a British phenomenon, but I've noticed it in the last couple of weeks in Texas. You know, when the hurricane struck and the flooding took place, I noticed I was seeing on CNN the other night, they were talking about the people getting into the little boats and saving their neighbors. And they talked about Texas was having its own Dunkirk. So this idea of Dunkirk spirit, which has always been such a British idea, is weirdly now being exported thanks to the movie. So it's an idea that's, you know, that's been with us all along. But I think only now that the film's come out is it sort of getting revived. And younger people are learning actually what Dunkirk was.
So it becomes more than just a name or just a phrase. I suppose in the same way that for Americans, when someone says, remember the Alamo, you might have only the vaguest notion of what happened at the Alamo or why it was significant and only take from it a very sort of general, generic kind of inspiration rather
than... Exactly that. Yeah, the incident itself gets somehow lost in the mist of time. And as you say, the generic expression, you know, with a sort of fairly simplistic meaning lives on. But it's quite, you know, one good result of the film is that, you know, the idea is being linked with the event once again. And in a very, very, you know, real, very intense, visceral way, because the film is so in your face. It's so intense that, you know, people go and see it and they are still talking about it and thinking about it days and weeks later because, you know, the film really sets out to show what it was like for people on, you know, during that period at Dunkirk. So I think, you know, it is bringing it alive for a lot of people who will never have heard of it before.
We'll talk about the film in just a little bit. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Joshua Levine, and we're talking about his most recent book, which is called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture. Joshua Levine was a historical consultant on the making of this marvelous film, written and directed by Christopher Nolan. So explain to our listeners, first of all, the defeat out of which Dunkirk emerged, the Allied defeat that made this evacuation at Dunkirk necessary. Where and under what circumstances did this really serious and in some ways even humiliating reversal occur?
Well, at the beginning of the Second World War, the British Expeditionary Force, that is virtually the entire British Army, went out to France. And the understanding was that they went out at the beginning of the war when the Germans mounted an attack on France, on Belgium, then they would move forward to face the German army. Just as the French army would move forward into Belgium, the Belgian army would face the Germans. And the expectation was it was going to be another very static war like the First World War, a war of trenches, a war of two large armies facing off against each other and probably not making a great deal of headway for a long time. But that's not what happened because the Germans mounted a surprise attack through the Ardennes forest, which is a heavily forested area, which wasn't protected by the Maginot Line. Now, the Maginot Line was the French defense. It was a series of forts all along the border that the French decided were completely impregnable. The Germans would not be able to get through. They would not pass. And in fact, the Germans didn't pass across the Maginot Line. They passed across this area that wasn't defended and was only very barely defended by French troops. And this was the area in the Ardennes. The Germans, with their panzer divisions of tanks, zipped through, moved very quickly through the Ardennes against all expectations and just headed straight for the coast. And in a matter of days, they'd reached the French coast. Now, nobody expected this. It was a very dangerous, very risky strategy by the Germans. It was given the go-ahead by Hitler. Most of the German generals didn't think it had any chance of success, but it did succeed. And it meant that the Germans had reached the coast so quickly, they had almost outflanked the entire British army who were left behind. And so all they had to do really was move round and they would have completely encircled the British and much of the French army. So all the British army could do was to retreat. The soldiers themselves didn't know why they were retreating for a long time. They had all sorts of ideas about why it was. But they had to retreat, and they had to retreat back to the only port that was available to them, which was Dunkirk. Once they were all in this little pocket around Dunkirk that was then defended by the French army on one side, the British army on the other side, with the Germans at all sides trying to get in and attacking from the air, that is when they had to somehow be rescued back to England. And that was why the Royal Navy and the small ships, not so many, but small ships with civilians manning them, if you see the film, you'll see this happen. That's when they came out from England and they started to take the British army back. At the beginning of the evacuation, it looked as though, you know, with luck, maybe something like 30, 40, 45,000 troops would be rescued back to Britain. In the end, 338,000 troops were rescued. It was the bulk of the British army, and it meant that the war could continue. It wasn't just the British army, also a large number of French troops, well over 100,000 French soldiers were taken back, Belgian soldiers, Dutch soldiers, even some Poles, a lot of people got back, and it meant that the war could continue. That's how important this was, because, you know, as you said earlier on, if Britain had been forced to surrender, which almost certainly would have happened if the army hadn't got back, then Britain would have become, as Churchill said himself, a slave state to Germany. You would have had the Nazification of Europe, effectively, the whole of Europe. There would have been no second front for the Americans to join. It's hard to see how there ever could have been any D-Day. It's hard to see how Europe could ever have been liberated. It's hard to see how the world could have been anything but very, very dark nowadays.
Right.
So you're right. Important event.
Yes, you write, had these soldiers been killed or captured, Britain would surely have been forced to seek a peace settlement with Hitler. History would have taken a far darker course, and we would all be living in a very different world today. Ahead of us talking about what almost miraculously occurred at Dunkirk with that evacuation, I want you to say a further word about the British retreat. You spend some time in the chapter called Survival describing this retreat. And the more we read, the more unsettling it is. That is, we have this sense of a very chaotic, bewildering situation in which many of these soldiers did not know exactly from whom or why they were in retreat. You also tell us that all sorts of different kinds of soldiers were part of this mass retreat. Tell us more about that. Describe the scope and the chaos that was part of this desperate retreat from the Nazis.
Well, as you say, it was chaotic, and it was unplanned. This was the trouble. The British had never intended to retreat. So at the beginning of the retreat, it tended to be larger units moving back together and defending. So they were moving back at the beginning to certain strong points which they knew they could defend. And so they were then having to fight against the Germans who were moving in on them from all sides. They were holding a corridor for a lot of the time, a corridor through which the Germans could, the British rather, and the French could retreat, and they were having to hold the sides of this corridor. They're having to hold it firm to fight against the Germans, to stop the Germans actually breaking in and preventing the retreat from taking place. Because never mind the evacuation, if the troops couldn't actually retreat back into Dunkirk, then there wouldn't be any evacuation at all in the first place. And you also had, it's interesting, you had lots of different kinds of soldiers, because bear in mind you had the fighting soldiers, the soldiers who had gone from France, out to France first, and then into Belgium with the intention of fighting against the Germans. But you also had a lot of other soldiers who were never intended to fight. Some of them were literally untrained. They had never held a gun. These were people who were meant to do the digging. They were meant to do the pioneer work. They were meant to do the sort of backroom and labor jobs. But they found themselves having to retreat just at the same time as the fighting soldiers having to retreat and having to fight. They were given guns, they were given weapons, things they'd never been trained to use, and told to use them, told they were going to have to defend a particular point. So you had all sorts of unusual, some of them were younger, some of them were older. A lot of the soldiers, it's interesting, if you see pictures of the British expeditionary force in France, some of these people, particularly these pioneers who weren't meant to fight, these were older men. These were, you know, some of them were veterans of the First World War. They were in their 40s, some of them even in their 50s. And bear in mind that, you know, at this time, people tended to look older when they were younger than they do today. So some of the photographs you see of these, you know, men in their late 40s, early 50s, they really do look like quite old men. But there they were in France with the expeditionary force having to fight their way through. And when the troops had got back to a certain point, that's when the perimeter around Dunkirk was formed. And that perimeter was formed of all sorts of different troops who were basically told to sacrifice themselves. They were told the British expeditionary force and the French and others would have to get away and they would have to hold the line until they couldn't do it, physically couldn't do it anymore. And that meant you had all sorts of extraordinary events I talk about in the book. For example, one group of British guardsmen, who were one of the crack regiments of the British Army, they were told to stay and defend this point basically to death. Nothing was going to make them give up their position. And they were defending their position, and they were visited by the officer of the unit next to them, who was defending the position next to them, so another British officer, who came along to them and said, look, I can't hold our position any longer. I'm going to retreat. And the guards officer said to him, you are not going to retreat. You're going to hold your position. He said, no, I'm going to retreat. And the guards officer said, if you move beyond that tree there, or any of your men move beyond that tree there, pointing at a tree, then we will shoot you. I warned you. Now go back to your position. So the officer went back to his position. He had a conference with his officers, and he moved beyond the tree. And three rifles, British rifles, opened up and shot another British officer. That's the kind of thing that was happening. That's how serious it was. That's how seriously people took their role of defending the army as it was getting away. It was truly a matter of life and death, and it wasn't something that was taken lightly.
You certainly vividly describe the state of these soldiers as they arrived in Dunkirk, those who were fortunate enough to arrive in Dunkirk. You write, so shattered, bloody, and demoralized. And of course, once they got to Dunkirk, of course, they found a scene of utter chaos that was not exactly reassuring. Before we describe that, say a quick word about geographically why Dunkirk. Why did it make sense for all of these troops to be funneled towards Dunkirk?
Dunkirk was a large port. It was a large working port. And the way that the situation had panned out, the Germans had been able to take Calais, they've been able to take Boulogne, they've been able to take basically the other ports on the French coast from which the British could get back to England. The only port that was available to the British that hadn't been taken by the Germans was Dunkirk. So it quite simply was available to them, and they were able to retreat down their defended corridor into this port. Now, the Germans made a very, very good job of attacking it from the air. So at the beginning of the evacuation, on the 26th of May 1940, the 27th of May 1940, the Germans bombed it very, very heavily. They actually put the port itself out of action. So this gave the British Army a huge headache. That, you know, they couldn't use the port itself. How on earth were they going to get home? How on earth were they going to pick up ships? Where were the ships going to come in? So they had to use initiative. And what they did, a man called William Tennant of the Royal Navy was brought out to Dunkirk, where his job was to organize the evacuation from the shore. And what he decided to do was to call into action a large breakwater, a breakwater that was called the Mole. Now, this Mole, people often think of it as a jetty. It wasn't a jetty. It was never intended for a ship to come alongside it. It was purely a breakwater to stop the harbor sanding up. It was a huge mile-long arm that sat out protecting the harbor.
And excuse me. And is this something that would have been intended to be walked upon?
It would only, it had a very narrow walkway on the top, a wooden walkway with barriers at the side. But that walkway was only meant for people to walk along it to mend it when it was broken. It was never meant for anybody to walk along it to board a ship to the side. So it wasn't intended for anybody really to walk along, only in an emergency. So it was, you know, it wasn't an obvious thing to use. Also, you know, there was a tidal drop of something like 15 feet. And so any ships that did try and come alongside it would either be, you know, sometimes would be so low in the water that, they, you know, they'd have been, you know, something like 25 feet away from the top of the Mole. So it was, you know, it was not a useful thing for boarding ships. It was not, no ship had ever come alongside it before to be boarded. It wasn't in any way a practical matter. But what William Tennant decided was, we have really nothing to lose. We better bring this and see what happened if we use it. So he brought one ship alongside it and lined soldiers up, and they were able to basically jump from the Mole onto the ship, and he decided, we will do this. And so over the rest of the evacuation, something like 100,000 soldiers got away from the Mole. They were queuing up the Mole, getting off. All sorts of ships were coming alongside. Some ships were coming alongside, and other ships were coming alongside those ships, so that people could use the middle ship as a platform to get onto the far ship. They were trying everything they could. And other soldiers got off from the beaches. Now, the beaches, you had 10 miles of beaches reaching out from Dunkirk all along towards La Panne. So these are 10 miles of beaches through France and at the end, Belgium. So on the Belgian border. And you had soldiers waiting in queues on the beaches, but the beaches were so shallow, the water was so shallow, that the ships, you know, the large naval ships, the large ferries, the ships that were bringing the people home couldn't get in close enough for the soldiers to board. So what they had to do was to call out for small ships. This is what those famous Dunkirk small ships, the little ships that are so famous, that were brought over by civilians. These little ships came in close by the shore where soldiers could get on them, and then they ferried the soldiers out to the larger ships that were moored on shore. So between the Mole, between the little ships coming into shore and taking soldiers off to the large ships, that's how the soldiers got off at Dunkirk. And all the while, bear in mind, they were being bombed from the air by the Luftwaffe. The ships were being bombed as they were going out to sea. They were being mined. They were being torpedoed. It was incredibly difficult. It was incredibly stressful. Huge numbers of people died. But the fact was that people got away to fight another day. Because bear in mind, so many of those British soldiers who came back on D-Day, they had been at Dunkirk. These were the same people who'd been taken off the beaches on Dunkirk. They came back to Normandy 4 years later. It's a remarkable thing, but they were the same people.
Mm. We're speaking with Joshua Levine about his book, Dunkirk, the history behind the major motion picture. One of the things that you say again and again in this book is that there is no single picture, no single story that really tells the full tale of Dunkirk. That is, it so much depended on who you were and where you happened to be in terms of how you experienced Dunkirk. And I think in this book, you're going out of your way to point that out, because that's one of the things that maybe the film does a really good job of doing. Whereas so often Hollywood, when they get hold of a story like this, the story tends to be, in a sense, simplified, boiled down to its most basic level, and you sort of feel like every soldier essentially experienced the same thing with just a few details being different. It's clear that you want us not to see Dunkirk that way. Explain further why you think this is such an important matter.
I think it's important because it's so easy to simplify an event. It's so easy just to be able to describe an event in a few words and then never think about it again. And I think that's been done with Dunkirk and so many things over the years, because the reality of the situation is that Dunkirk, the evacuation took place along 10 miles of beaches. You had hundreds of thousands of people involved. It took place over nearly 10 days. You had all sorts of people present. You had all sorts of events, all kinds of behavior. People behaving very well in the queues to get on the ships. People jumping the queues, jumping the lines to stop other people getting on the ships and to get on ahead of time. People behave well. They behave badly. You had all sorts of behavior. You had people who had a terrible, terrible time. They were in appalling condition when they came through the perimeter, when they finished the retreat, when they came into Dunkirk. You have stories of people who hadn't eaten along the way, were so hungry, they were trying to eat the leather off their helmet straps. People who were had been walking and their boots had worn off and the leather on their boots had worn off and the skin on their feet had worn down to the bone. You had horrifying stories of people's condition, but then you also had, I found a story of a man who had arrived into Dunkirk with his friends, gone onto the beach for a bit, then decided that they were going to try walking away from the beach, where they found a restaurant that was still open. These three men from the Royal Engineers, they ordered bottles of champagne, and they drank bottles of champagne while the evacuation was taking place in a restaurant, in an estaminet behind the lines. They were all working class boys. They'd never tried it before. One man said he absolutely loved it, and he was going to drink champagne for the rest of his life. So here we have extraordinary contrast, as you would expect, between the experiences of people who were there at Dunkirk. And all it shows you is that there wasn't one story, there weren't two stories, five stories, 100 stories. There were hundreds of thousands of different stories, one for every man on the beach. And we've got to stay open and listen to those stories, to the people who knew what it was genuinely like to be there.
Hmm. One of the things that you describe quite vividly is the sight of these huge lines. In fact, you tell of a naval officer arriving at Dunkirk and approaching from the sea. You write, he was struck by one of the most pathetic sights he had ever seen. To the east of the port were 10 miles of beach, the entire length blackened by tens of thousands of men. As he drew closer, he could see that many had waded into the water, queuing for a turn to tumble into the pitiable little boats. The scene seemed hopeless. It's just not the kind of thing we imagine in wartime, soldiers lined up in these enormous queues. And as you say, in certain cases, some of the soldiers in those lines behaving badly, not wanting strangers to join them or whatever. It's a chilling scene to contemplate.
There were beachmasters on the beaches whose job it was to actually keep order in those lines. And I was very lucky. I went to visit one of those beachmasters, a man called Harold Vic Viner, who died just a few months ago. But I went to see him a couple of years ago, and I spoke to him at some length. And he spoke about the fact that, you know, for the most part, there was great order in his queue. But every now and again, somebody would cause difficulty. Somebody would, for whatever reason, would try and jump the queue, perhaps because they were experiencing a particularly hard time, perhaps they were suffering from shell shock or its equivalent. Perhaps, you know, it could be any number of reasons, but several times he was forced to actually draw his pistol and to threaten people. And on one occasion, he actually threatened an officer, and the two of them stood there with their guns pointing at each other. And, you know, in the end, the officer backed down. But that was what it was like in the queue. I mean, when he was doing this for several days, under regular attack from the Stukas, from the dive bombers, which he said was absolutely terrifying. When the dive bombers came at you, absolutely terrifying. Although, when the dive bombers' bombs landed in the sand, quite interesting that actually when a bomb lands in the sand, it's very, very unusual. It explodes. And it doesn't, it's not as deadly as it would be landing on concrete or landing on some rock or some sort of hard surface. It buries itself in the sand and creates very, very strange ripples over a relatively large area. He said that, you know, the whole experience was very, very strange. And another thing that he saw that was very odd was several people who obviously just had enough for whatever reason, whether, you know, they'd been driven to it by madness, whether they genuinely felt they could swim back to England, people who just swam out as though they were going to swim back to England. In fact, they had no chance of doing so. He described it, Biner described these people as committing suicide. Actually, we don't know what was going on in their minds. Perhaps they were so disturbed, they were so unhinged by what was happening. Perhaps they had no idea what they were doing. But the fact was they did this. And the fact also was that Christopher Nolan was so affected by this story from Harold Vick-Viner that he actually put it into the film. It's one of the scenes that's made it into the film. Hmm. So it was, he was an extraordinary person to listen to and to see these cues, because as you say, cueing is not something that you expect to see in wartime as part of a battle. It is, however, something that is very often associated with the British.
Right.
The British are often said to cue at the drop of a hat. Well, here were British and others, and French and Belgians and all sorts of people queuing to get on ships, but they were queuing to save their lives and they were queuing to save their country.
Mm-hmm. And of course, yes, standing in line, but for something so desperate, a matter of life and death. And we need to say a word about the other half of this equation, namely all of these civilians who were part of this desperate evacuation with their own boats, having received little or no comprehensive training on how to even do such a thing. It seems to me that is maybe the single most astounding miracle in all of this, that element of this evacuation went as well as it did.
Well, I think, first of all, we've got to be careful about overstressing the role of the civilians. Certainly civilians did go across in their own boats, and civilians did do an astonishing job. The majority of soldiers were rescued by the Royal Navy,
right.
And even the small ships, most of the small ships were crewed by members of the Royal Navy. Often, funnily enough, members of the Royal Navy who didn't really know what they were doing. It would have been better if they'd had their own civilian crews, because their civilian crews would have known how, you know, the foibles and of their own ships, of their own little boats. But the fact is, there were a significant number of civilians there, and they rose to the task, as you would, in a way, expect them to, because, you know, there was so much at stake. I mean, even though, you know, at this time, for most of the evacuation, actually, the British people didn't know what was going on. It wasn't being reported that there was an evacuation taking place. British people knew from the newspapers and from the radio news that a retreat had taken place, but it was only, relatively late in the day of the evacuation that they were told. I mean, they had to be told eventually, because lots of soldiers were showing up in Britain. And so it became absolutely clear that there was evacuation taking place. They had to be told. But, for most of the time, when the civilians were out there helping the soldiers to get away, the people didn't actually know. So these civilians, you know, they were absolutely risking their lives. They were doing something incredibly dangerous, but they rose to the challenge. And it's... as you say, it's a wonderful story. It's an extraordinary story. It's something to be very, very proud of. And it's something to hold up as an example. It's why this week, or last week in Houston, it was being held up as an example. People were comparing, you know, the brave efforts of the people with their own boats. They were comparing it to Dunkirk. And it seems to me it's a fairly apt comparison.
Absolutely. You also tell us that when these British soldiers arrived back in Britain, you tell us most soldiers saw themselves as the wretched remnants of a trampled army. Many felt ashamed, but they were confounded by the unexpected public mood. That is, they did not expect to be, in a sense, welcomed back as heroes.
That's right. That's right. They felt they'd been soundly beaten, and they felt they were coming back with their tails between their legs. In fact, you know, I think the instinctive British reaction was one of relief. The fact that the army was coming home, well, several things. First of all, the fact that the army was coming home meant that people's sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, friends, relations were going to be home. But beyond that, it meant that Britain still had a chance. It meant that the war wasn't over. Britain was still fighting. So it was an instinctive relief from the British people. And that relief took the form of treating these men as though they were returning heroes. Some of them were delighted to be treated that way. Others were quite embarrassed to be treated that way.
Hmm. A last question. In the film, Christopher Nolan makes the choice to essentially leave the enemy largely invisible, and to some extent even largely unnamed. It's a very, very intriguing and I think very effective choice. What is your reaction to that particular facet of this film?
I think it's an excellent idea. I think it's a very, very interesting, very innovative idea. I think it's, well, for two reasons. One, from an accuracy point of view, and another from a film making point of view. From an accuracy point of view, if you think about the experience of the average soldier in Dunkirk, he wouldn't have seen the enemy. You know, he would have been there in this perimeter. He would have seen the airplanes falling out of the sky at him. He would have seen the bombs coming down. He would have seen, experienced the shelling. He would have seen torpedoes. He might have seen mines. There are all sorts of evidence of the enemy, but he would never have seen an enemy soldier. So it's actually accurate from a sort of first-person perspective, which is what this film in many ways is. But beyond that, it's also fascinating as a piece of art, because it means it's almost not a war film. It makes it almost a psychological thriller. The idea that the enemy is, you know, it's not the Nazis, it's not the Germans, it's your own worst fear. It's almost Orwell's Room 101. Whatever's in Room 101 is your own great personal fear. And here, the Nazis are your own, as the audience, as the man on the beach, it is your own great personal fear coming to get you. And that makes it really quite a fascinating thing.
It truly, truly is. The film, of course, is Dunkirk, and your marvelous book is called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture, published by William Morrow and Division of HarperCollins. Joshua Levine, thank you so much for writing this marvelous book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for having me.
And what a pleasure and honor for me to be speaking with one of the world's most beautiful and most stylish women, India Hicks.
That's very generous.
She's the daughter of a famed British decorator, David Hicks, and the daughter of Lady Pamela Hicks. And I want to begin by asking you about your parents and to what extent the woman you are today, both as an entrepreneur and in terms of your own distinctive sense of style, how much of that can we trace to them and to the life that you had with them?
That is a really interesting question, and I'm so glad we've started with that. That's given me a pause to think. I think an awful lot. I am exceptionally close to my mother, who was an extraordinary character and is an extraordinary character. She is 88. And I am literally two fields away from her right now. She's just in her own home across the road. And she has had really a front row seat at many extraordinary events. She was with the Queen the moment the Queen became Queen. She was a lady in waiting. She went on that amazing Royal Commonwealth tour. She was out in India with my grandfather, who was the last viceroy. So that meant that when India was being handed back from Britain to be independent, my mother was there, so she sat with Mahatma Gandhi in prayer meetings. She then married my father, who was completely mad, very vibrant, very flamboyant. They lived an extraordinary life as my father dazzled the world with his incredible color schemes and geometric patterns and his incredible eye for design. So both of my parents were individually very unique and very, very broad-minded in their thinking. And I would like to think or hope that I got the best of both of them. So I'm very passionate about design, but I'm very aware about, hopefully about giving back and being loyal and being dutiful and just being grateful for the extraordinary life that I have been blessed with.
Nicely put. I want to quote something that your mother said in an extraordinary documentary a number of years ago called The Windsors, which was about the history of the royal family. And in talking about the current queen, your mother, Lady Pamela Hicks, I remember her saying, you know, a lot of people would wonder, to be queen. Oh, you know, wouldn't that be the most wonderful thing? Yes, maybe for a day, but for a lifetime? And, you know, she's suggesting that kind of a life when it is your entire life is actually an extraordinary responsibility and burden. And I can see what you are saying when your mother clearly has a sense of duty and honor and integrity, and obviously that's something that is very much a part of who you are as well.
Well, I would like to think so. My mother was close to the Queen and did have an insight into our extraordinary sovereign. And I think my mother is right. Imagine that is something that is duty beyond, to have a lifetime of working for your nation, for your country. And my mother is an extraordinary example of someone who has always been forward thinking in the same way that our Queen is. I think that the modernization of the monarchy in England is something that we should all feel proud of. I think the work that those boys, Harry and William, are doing at the moment is exceptional. And I think it's an exciting time. It's interesting that I've very much chosen a life out of England, and that I've based and founded a company that's in America. And I have really had the most extraordinary experiences traveling across your great country, meeting amazing people, seeing very diverse backgrounds, and your history also is quite remarkable.
I want to ask you just one question about Princess Diana. You were a bridesmaid at her wedding. I wonder, when you think about her sense of style and the way she carried herself, and particularly once she sort of surmounted some of those difficulties when she was so young and in the spotlight and became such an admired woman, I wonder what lessons you feel like you maybe learned from her in whatever respect is significant.
Another quite hard question. I think Diana was exceptional, as we all know, in many ways. She had what we all can recognize was star quality. When she walked into a room, you took notice. Now, are you born with that, or do you learn that? Who knows? But I think she was blessed with great looks, an extraordinary charisma, a human touch, great style. And I think all of that combined made her the person she is. What was interesting was what she did with that, and that she didn't sit still, and she took it and used it for the greater good. I think, though, that we must never forget how hard Prince Charles also works, and that he is also a man of deep passion and understanding, and is very, very involved with so many exceptional causes in England and globally. And I think just being part of the royal family, they do have a sense of duty, and the fact that they do need to take the what has been given to them and use it to the better. Diana was a particular example and character. And I think, you know, 20 years on, as we now mark the anniversary of her death, we should see it more as a celebration and less as mourning the loss of her, and see the example that she set. And I like to think that I do in some tiny, weeny, weeny small part take the example. I'm incredibly proud that the company that I founded, IndiaHicks.com, we have a get-together, give-together program that allows women who are partnering with us to donate a percentage of their sales, and we as a company match in part some of those sales, and that we really don't dictate which company or foundation or charitable cause our women is giving back to. We allow them to do that. So giving back is a big part of us. I'm blessed to live in a small island in the Bahamas. I have five children, one of whom we fostered, and he is a Bahamian chap, and he has brought me much happiness, and I think has really shown me the way in so many places and in so many life lessons. So again, I feel very lucky to have a very multidimensional family who are teaching me every day how to give back and be responsible as we get older. I was 50 yesterday. I can hardly bear it.
Wow.
So my goodness, getting older is topical.
Right. And it beats the alternative, that's for sure. You in creating your company a couple of years ago, went out of your way to create it in such a way that that your beautiful things are sold through a network of entrepreneurial women versus sold to stores who put it on a shelf. Why was that so important to you?
Well, you've put that very nicely. That's exactly right. I really looked and thought that for a number of things, there were sort of two forces at work at the time that we were launching the company. There was the kind of the crumbling of retail and how difficult it is now to shop and really to succeed if you're just launching a company. But also I saw so many of my friends with their children growing up and leaving home, and women feeling a bit of a sense of the empty nester, or they had got to a stage where they had worked very hard as a good wife and a good daughter and a good mother and a good parent, and it was time really for women to find something for themselves again, to feel relevant within the home, to take pride in earning their own money, to giving back to the family income. And I just thought, if we take this lifestyle brand and we launch it not in boutiques and not in stores, but back in the heart of the home, literally, quite literally, from the kitchen table, and partner with women who are looking for a more entrepreneurial adventure, I thought there's something really exciting about that. Mm-hmm. And I've made the most amazing friends through this. We have women joining us from across America, from different walks of life, and we're having an awful lot of fun doing it at the same time, and that's really important.
And you were given Good Housekeeping Magazine's 2017 Entrepreneurship and Female Empowerment Award for this year. So we congratulate you on that and direct people to your website, indiahicks.com, for more information and to see some of the beautiful things which you have designed. India Hicks, we wish you well.
Thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyable.